Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AHTT. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Hard to Tell podcast, episode 119, Dexter Henry, Brian Fonseca. We got some friends with us, all quarantining from home. Got my man from the Bros Pod, writer for the Undefeated, Jamal Murphy. Jamal, what's up, man?
What up, what up? Glad to be here again.
And we got our other good friend from the 7-Footers Pod. Also can find some of his work writing on BET.com. My man, Gerard Hector. Gerard, what's up, man?
Listen, man, I'm just out here. It's happy to be on with y'all. Happy to see my boys on this podcast. It's nice to see y'all. Just trying to stay alive out here in these Rona streets, man.
Yes, sir. Should we resume our off-mic conversation that we were having to start this podcast or no?
Definitely not. Let's just, for the listeners I will, and the viewers, I would just say Brian was being all kinds of ridiculous.
Inappropriate.
He wasn't being violent, although we did learn that in his previous parts of his life, he has thrown some things while playing video games, which if you listen to this podcast should shock nobody.
I was on another podcast this week, and the way I started the podcast when they asked me how I was doing was like, look, man, I'm good. A man only needs three things during these quarantine times.
Oh, Lord.
Food. Lord. What? Y'all are...
Oh, Lord.
This isn't going to end well. Nothing about this will end well.
It's just food, video games, and lotion. You know what I'm saying? That's it. That's it. Like, so we good out here.
Wow. Okay.
Look, man, look, a lot of people are stressed out during these times. A lot of people are actually watching press conferences and not living in the bubble like they should be at this point in their lives. Because honestly, we're never going to get this time again. We're never going to be allowed to live in a bubble and not work. It's like we're all in high school. You know what I'm saying? We're trapped in the crib. So people just got to embrace it. So, you know, food, video games, and lotion. That's it. Yeah, everybody got Netflix, baby.
Yeah, you strike me as a person that's really embracing that lotion.
Nah, I'm good. I'm good, son. I'm good. I'm saying dudes need it because, you know, the amount of times you're washing your hands, now everybody's hands get dry.
Man, shut up. That is not what you're talking about.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
All right. We are moving on. As usual, another ridiculous start to this podcast. We are moving on. The reason we have gathered our friends here today, we wanted to talk about a documentary that recently came out on HBO, The Scheme, and I thought for two good reasons we got Jamal and Gerard for this. One, for people who don't know, The Scheme is kind of about the FBI investigation, and I'll put investigation in air quotes, into NCAA and players getting paid and coaches taking money to play players and all that kind of stuff, and how it centers around one central character, which we'll get to in this. We all watch this. I'm going to start first with reactions because I'm very intrigued to what everybody thought about it. Specifically, I really was intrigued to what Murph, and I talked a little bit about Murph about this before we started this, because Murph has wrote about this. He's spoken about this. He was in season 3 of the Sports Walk talking about this very issue in college basketball and some of the fraudulent behavior. And it's not about players taking money. It's about the scam of the NCAA. What did you guys think about The Scheme overall? Brian, I know you got some thoughts. But Jamal, I'm going to kick it off with you first. What did you think about this documentary when you watched it?
I mean, first and foremost, I thought it was necessary that people got, you know, a point of view that was different from, you know, the powers that be, whether it's the NCAA or the federal government. So I thought it was necessary. I thought, you know, not everybody would be paying attention to, you know, the nuts and bolts of the case, when it was going on. You know, if you had, you know, not everybody likes to read, you know, reactions to it. So I was glad that it came on TV to where people, you know, someone could show exactly what was going on and what the FBI was doing and what the end result was. I thought there was some good information on there. I do value Christian Dawkins, you know, his opinion on it. I mean, he was one of the major players in the investigation on the wrong end of it, for sure. And all of the wiretaps that came out, I thought was very important that people were able to hear that for themselves and see how corrupt these NCAA coaches are, and how, you know, and how they give you one face in front of the camera in press conferences, and what they're doing on the phone in order to get big time talent is a totally different thing. So I thought it was great that HBO had this on and we were able to see inside a little bit. Was it the greatest documentary ever? No. Christian Dawkins kind of embraced it a little too much as being a star and trying to be funny and all that kind of stuff. So I get some of the criticism of it, but overall, I think it was a good thing.
Cool. Gerard, what are your thoughts on the doc? I know you've spoken to the director and some of the creators, mm-hmm. people behind this, which is why we have you on here to talk about this. But what did you think about it?
So, you know, it's something that we had alluded to when we had off mic when we started our conversation. And, you know, Dexter, you threw out the phrase, Murph, you threw out the phrase, this is America, right? And I think in that case, you got an encapsulation in a small way, who and what we are as a nation and as a country, right? The federal government initially decided that they were going to go after the institution that is college basketball, right? Because of the corruption and underhandedness that goes on in college basketball, right? And those are words that I don't use. That's words that their media machine uses, right? And their media machine includes the NCAA themselves and their sycophants in the media, some of our colleagues who champion whatever it is that they do as like everything being upholding and right and supporting this system of amateurism when nothing can be further from the truth, right? This is a multi-billion dollar organization and the labor is largely black and largely poor, right? Or from lesser means, yet they're not able to get paid. And what happened was they zeroed in on, okay, we're going to try to take these coaches down. We're going to remember the district attorney from the Southern District said, we have your playbook, right? And then they were coming after them. We're going to take down this system. You mean to tell me Christian Dawkins is the system that is wrong with college? Him, this one dude is what's wrong with all of college basketball. Come on, man. What we saw was their inability to get the top guys. And I have theories as to why that is. And I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit later. So they couldn't get to the top guys. Dawkins wouldn't roll on anybody. And they said, well, okay, then plea out, whatever. He didn't want to plea out. He decided, it's my right. If you charge me with something, I have a right to go to trial. And what this country does historically and this criminal justice system does, if you dare have the audacity to fight your own case, which is your right, oh, we're going to punish you now, right? Homie's is sentenced to jail for 18 months for what? Paying a basketball player? How do you think they go to these schools? Let's keep it 100. How do you think Roy Williams, Coach Krzyzewski, Sean Miller, Rick Pitino, how do they get these guys versus their other squads? It ain't because I love Duke or I love Carolina or the Brotherhood or whatever nonsense these people say. It ain't that. What are the benefits I'm getting on the back end to get me in here? And Christian Dawkins is someone who recognized, yo, this is the American dream. I see an avenue for myself and a lane. I can help these guys get to this place. And as a result, I'm going to get paid off of it. The problem is they only want certain people getting paid off that, not people like Christian Dawkins.
Yeah, for people who don't know Christian Dawkins, interesting character. I'm forgetting the town. What's the town he's from in Michigan, guys? What town is he from?
Saginaw,
right? He's from Saginaw, Michigan. His dad coached the high school team there. Draymond Green was on that team. Mm-hmm. He basically looked at this guy as kind of like an entrepreneur in a way in this documentary.
He's exactly an entrepreneur.
He is an entrepreneur. He funded, he got a shoe deal for his AAU team. He really built that up. He got into the agency world, was connected with Andy Miller. There were some issues there. I don't want to ruin things for people who haven't seen the documentary that you can see there. And then he was trying to get into the world of college basketball and really start his own agency and build his own name by getting players to coaches, right? So in my eyes, looking at this, this was a dude who was trying to make his moves into this world, but the system was trying to take him down. Brian, I know, we know you have some issues with the film, with the documentary.
You wildin', Brian. Here you go.
What, just only as a documentary. Only as a documentary itself. Like, in terms of the story, I agree. These are things that need to be told. And it's the reason I watched it. You know, I wanted to see, you know, what was going on in this case. Why did it disappear? What happened after they played the wiretaps and all these sort of things? And then when I watched the scheme, it's like a Christian Dawkins infomercial, which is cool, I guess. But also it's like it's 120 minutes. And I would probably say roughly half of that are Christian Dawkins interviews.
I want to know
more about the actual problem here, right? And the actual problem being the NCAA and why, you know, that part of it. And really, it's just a Christian Dawkins infomercial.
Do you give any, and I'm going to let Gerard come in on this one. Do you get, because he's the one who spoke to people who worked on this, do you give any bit of lax or sort of leeway to the people who worked on this, because all they really had to go off with this was mostly Christian Dawkins, his lawyer, and his family.
Then don't make it 2 hours. Then don't make it two hours.
So, yeah.
For me, like it should have been a 90-minute film or even 60 minutes if it's just going to be mostly Christian Dawkins and his lawyer, the lawyer that was also interviewed heavily in that.
Right.
Well, as you guys know,
if you don't have enough perspectives, you can't make that long of a piece, period.
We're all creatives here, right? And if we're doing a story or any kind of piece, we try to get as many divergent opinions on the situation as we can and as we'll allow in the format that we're creating. One of the challenges is with filmmaking is, right, it's part ideology from the beginning, right? And the director's ideology. And when I talked to the director, Pat, he had said to me, you know, I came in being like, you know, I was a college basketball fan and I knew there was corruption going on, but it's just par for the course. You know, Pat told me, because he had met with Christian, and I think what happened to him was he, like everybody else, and this goes back to something you said, Dexter, was enamored by Christian. You have to think about this in the sense that this is a dude who literally, and here's the thing, if you can't leverage the relationships you have in your life, well, then what are they for, right? Like, right, from a business standpoint. And that's what he did. He's like, wait a minute. I have all these connections to all these prep school kids and people want to know about them. Well, what the hell? I got to figure out a way. And it's not a situation where he's robbing the players or taking their money. It's, oh, they want to go to this school? Cool. Well, it's going to cost this amount of money. You got to, because their aunt's got to pay light bills. They got this, right? Because again, a lot of these players come from economically disadvantaged positions. And while I'm doing that, I'm going to get hooked up as part of the process. You make billions of dollars. It's cool. On the creative side, though, Brian, I hear your point. But when you only have that to go from and you don't have the FBI ball in the play ball, you don't have any of the schools ball in the play ball, you don't have anybody else who's on the other side who wants to talk, all you have is Christian Dawkins, right? That's the bulk of your film. And so then it becomes this idea where it's like, hey, this is all about Christian Dawkins. But I think what that highlights and the way I look at it is that you realize what a farce it is. You're trying to tell me this, and this is not a downgrade of him. You're trying to tell me this guy, this is the problem with all of college basketball? This right. One dude who had five players, him? He's the dude that's in charge of all this? Come on, man, stop.
Well, I think that unless you're doing, like, for example, if you're writing a story and you've been assigned to do, I don't know, a 4,000-word feature, right. A 4,000-word just story about this, right. And you're getting all these sources and things like that. If a lot of people aren't willing to play ball with you, and what you mostly have is Christian Dawkins, then if you're going to turn that into a Christian Dawkins profile, your editor's probably going to tell you, all right, instead of making this 4,000 words, it'll be 3,000 or 2,500. Yeah. That's just the way things go.
Yeah, but the difference.
Video's a different medium.
Though, yeah, the video's a different medium, and I agree with that. Gerard, I'm sorry to cut you off.
But video, 2 hours, though.
Yeah, but
it doesn't need to be 2 hours.
I think the time's a fair point.
The mom crying in the letter at the end was like,
What we're tapping into right now is emotions, and Brian doesn't really like emotions like that. Like,
no,
it's anger.
But fundamentally, what does that have to do with the NCAA's case?
What does that have to do with the FBI investigation? I actually didn't have a problem with that letter at the end and what it did, and I liked where they placed it, actually. I thought the direction was nice because it showed the mindset that Christian Dawkins had from the jump about all this, and it spoke to who he was trying to be, which I agree with Gerard, shows more of why it's a farce. But let's talk to somebody who actually
I know what's actually going on here. I know what's actually going on here.
Oh,
yes,
okay.
Yes. I respect it. You guys are supporting the young black entrepreneur.
And you know, first of all, I'm gonna push back a little bit on that, because I'm gonna say I'm not even gonna be ashamed of that. Yeah, you know what? I'm proud of that brother for being an entrepreneur and giving a big fuck you to the NCAA. I got no problem with that.
Yeah, however, if it was Christian Diaz, I might be hyped too.
However, no. If it was a Diaz, I'd be hyped for him too. I'm down with anybody giving an F you to the NCAA right now. Right.
Let me make that clear too, because my issue is not with Christian Dawkins. My issue is just the film itself.
The piece was, of art. Your issue is from an artistic standpoint.
Because I wanted more of an NCAA versus FBI, the wiretaps, and that.
You weren't going to get that because nobody was going to talk, though.
And by the way, we ain't never gonna get that. And you know there are
instead of calling it the scheme colon whatever, call it the scheme colon the Christian Dawkins story or some shit.
Well, let's ask somebody who actually wrote a story, and Jamal, who is here. Jamal, you wrote a story last year, and you and I spoke a lot about this. Was on Undefeated. Black assistant coaches were scapegoats in the NCAA recruiting trials. And I feel like that's one of the things that is absolutely highlighted through this piece. You see how the black coaches really are the scapegoats. They are the ones that are kind of used to bring these players to the head coaches, mainly in college basketball, which are white, as we see. And they're the ones that take the fall. In the situation of Christian Dawkins, he's talking with a lot of these coaches because he's got that connection. And they bring these players in, but these are the guys that are the ones that took the fall. Meanwhile, some of the white players that we saw in this, and I will say this for the people who could even watch the documentary, they got off real easy here, okay? They got off real easy. How big of a problem is this, Jamal? You've covered this. You've went in this world. You are a college basketball guru. How big of a problem is this?
Oh, it's a huge problem. I mean, and that was one of the things that stood out the most to me was the way, you know, the NCAA's role in this was the position that they put black coaches in. When I was researching the article I did was, you know, look, I went to the NCAA database and tried to see how many coaches of color there were. And when I first started to do that, I was expecting to see something like, you know, there aren't that many. There really aren't that many black assistant coaches, even as much as there should be. But what I found was that there are actually plenty of black assistant coaches. I think it was like 56% of assistant coaches in Power Five conferences were black, as far as basketball is concerned. So the real problem was when you looked at the head coaches, only 17% of head coaches were black. So they have no problem hiring black coaches to do the recruiting, to do all this dirty work, this illegal work.
To go into the neighborhoods that they don't want to go into.
To be the fall guy.
That's a good point. That's a point there.
So in a way, you know, they're hiring all these ex-black basketball players to be assistant coaches, really just to be the fall guy in situations like this. Because everybody knows what's going on. All these head coaches, as we know from the wiretaps, either are playing an active role, like the one, like who we saw in the wiretaps, of Will Wade,
Sean Miller.
You know, they're actively playing a role in this and actively talking about money. And then there are others who were not caught out there, but they all know what's going on. Patino, you know, they all know that these kids are getting paid from somebody. You know, there's no way they don't know that if we know that. So to me, that was the big issue is that, you know, these coaches are basically, they go in as scapegoats. You know, their job is to do the dirty, illegal work. And they have almost, you know, just a very small chance at really getting to where any assistant coach, when you're an assistant coach, what's your goal in life?
Be a head coach.
Mm. And that is unlikely to happen. And they're just really used to bring in the talent by whatever means necessary. And then when shit hits the fan, it's going to be them who pays, and those white head coaches are going to be fine.
I want to continue on that, Jamal, because you talked about the white head coaches being fine. The only coach that was implicated in all this, I believe, was Rick Pitino, right? And he had initially lost his job. But we kind of know that was
Iona's Rick Pitino.
Yeah, and I'm getting to that. we know that he, this is kind of a culmination of things with him and all the stuff that happened in Louisville, right? So it wasn't really just about this. Right. Brian just mentioned he now has the head coaching job at Iona, which kind of proves that point, right? That like, even if these coaches get hit on something, these white coaches, they're going to be all right.
And I guarantee you, Christian Dawkins will never get, well, I mean, he wasn't an assistant coach to begin with, but Merle Code, who was a one-time assistant coach, he worked for Adidas during this time. Mm-hmm. He's not going to get another. He's not going to get another job in the industry. No. The assistant coaches who did get caught up in, four of them pleaded guilty. They're not going to ever become coaches again. But meanwhile, the head coaches who oversaw the whole program. They will, you know, not only have they kept their job throughout all of this, but you know, even if they do, if they do pay a price at some point, they're very likely, you know, 5 years down the line to get another chance. So, I mean, that's a big issue.
And Gerard, I know you saw this too in the piece. That was a Wade Miller. His defiance, and Christian Dawkins talks about this, his defiance in this was, to me, the epitome of white privilege. In this and in the construct of NCAA in sports, right? And pretty much being like, nah, I'm still gonna work here and I'm still gonna do this thing. What was your reaction to that? Because that really infuriated me.
It was, you know, again, I mean, God, we've been knowing this has been going on forever. I was just kind of like, that sounds about right. To your point, Dexter, I was like, yeah, wait out here, like, y'all ain't gonna fire me. Here's the big thing, right, that we have to remember about all of this in college athletics. Generally speaking, and it's usually the football coach, but whatever, for a state school, the head football or head basketball coach are either the number one and or number two highest paid state employees, right? Here's why that matters. Because they then have access and they are people who connect with certain levels of government. And this is where it's all connected with why the feds couldn't push this case forward, right? How many people at your level are U of L alums, are LSU alums, or whatever? And at the next level up at the federal and circuit level, are also alums. Like, now we can't get our head coach fired. How much you want to bet a call was made or several calls were made to people that matter inside the feds and were like, listen, man, you ain't going after Pitino and these dudes. You got to, nah, go ahead. Take this Christian Dawkins guy. And that's the kind of clout and power these universities and these headmen, these universities have, that they can pull the strings behind the scenes. And then again, people like Dawkins are the fall guy, right? Because these universities are not going to, I don't even know what Wade makes, probably $2, $3 million a year. Like, come on, they're not dumping him. It's just much easier to get these assistant coaches and to make it seem like, look, it's these runners, right? Because runners is like this negative word we use. Yo, every agency needs someone who has relationships at the grassroots level. Andy Miller and all these top flight agents aren't hanging out in Saginaw, Michigan, watching basketball tournaments. Like, they're just not. They need someone who's got these relationships. Hey, you know this kid? Yeah. Who's his people? All right, yeah, they work with his family over here. All right, we're thinking about where they're going. It's a funnel system, right? Mm-hmm. And the money flows up top. It's how the rest of the world works, right? So this was no surprise to me. Again, this is a microcosm of the larger world. And generally speaking, it's white people who make out and who are afforded the luxuries and riches. And when we and people of color try to take the initiative and do things that they themselves do, oh no, you, and I'm gonna use a word that I don't like using. Nah, this ain't for you, my guy. No.
Right.
Nah, y'all ain't making this money. And now we're gonna make a federal case out of it. And now it's the end of it's World War XII. And it's not that serious, but that's how we work in this world. It's sad.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AHTT. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Brian, were you shocked by anything with this, you know, because I know you didn't like that it was a Christian Dawkins story, but was there anything in it? And I know how you feel about the NCAA, which is very similar to how we all feel here. But what was there anything in this documentary that shocked you at all?
No, not really. Like, because if you really think about it, I mean, everybody got off. The world keeps spinning regularly. You know, nobody gets fired. Rick Pitino just backpedals a lot from Louisville to Iona. But really, it wasn't even tied to that. That was because of the hooker shit.
Right.
I think that was because of
stuff before that. It's for Pitino. It was a cumulative effect. Sure. It was the hookers. It was the other recruiting stuff. It was stuff in Kentucky. It was like it was all
having sex and getting extorted.
Extorted.
Right.
I almost forgot about that.
Because of this. And by the way, that's not as bad as this. The hooker shit is whatever. Like, if you're gonna get hookers for your players to recruit them, that's how you're gonna get them to go to your school. Honestly,
had them on campus.
Yeah, on campus. That's the thing. Look. If I'm a five-star,
at least go to a strip club. God, dang.
Yeah, that's the thing.
No. I disagree. Bring them to campus. Because if I'm a five-star recruit, if I'm the 36th best player on the ESPN 100, I have a visit to your school, and you're bringing me hookers. I'm going to your school. Like, that's how that
Except
goes.
That's not how everyday campus life is, but I get your point. It's not a bad sell. Your point is it's not a bad sell.
You saw he got game, and you heard Jalen Rose talk about, like, yo, if I didn't get any pussy when I went to school, I wasn't going there. You know what I'm saying?
Let me just tell future, you know, high school players, you know, five-star, all-American high school players, you can do better than hookers, okay?
Yes. Agree.
I'm kind of mad. I'm kind of mad that has to be said, but that's a good PSA.
That's absolutely
a good PSA for sure. Go ahead, bro.
Right. But it's the thought that counts, right? You know what I mean? Like, at the end of the day, it's the thought that counts. Like, look, here's how we want to treat you on the way, you know, give you the king's welcome. But yeah, there's no surprises there. There's no surprises with Will Wade and with Rick. Like, just. Nobody really getting fired or nobody really getting any sort of discipline. Like, there weren't any suspensions worth note, like none of that stuff. And everything coming down on Christian Dawkins, Merle Code, who you mentioned before, Jamal, also went to prison for a while, or also went to jail. You know what I mean? So there was no surprises on that. And it's just a level of disappointment, obviously, because it sort of came and went. Like, the FBI getting involved, you would think that things would go much further, right? But evidently, they stopped at some point, and we have no idea where this goes from here, other than to think that, look, this is probably going to be it until the next case, and then we'll see what happens from there. And also, I do not believe El Chapo was upstairs from Christian Dawkins. I don't.
Well, yeah, who knows? But I will say, the NCAA, there will be...
Someone lied to him.
There will be things that happen as far as the NCAA is concerned. They're going to jump on this. You got Bill Self was a major player
in this,
too.
Yeah.
Wasn't on the wiretaps, but so people believe that Kansas will be on probation at some point next year. They might not be be able to make the NCAA tournament. NC State has already received something from the NCAA. I'm pretty sure LSU and Arizona will too. So the NCAA, even though they're hypocritical in all this, and they've known this has been going on also, but they are going to, you know, at least try to save themselves. And put, you know, a few schools on probation.
Can they, though? Can they save themselves, Murph?
No, they can't save themselves, but they'll think that they are.
Wait. I actually have a legit...
About that probation thing. What was the joke, and I think Tarkanian said it, is that whenever school X commits a violation, school Y and Z get put on probation? Like, who was the joke? It's like, whenever Kentucky, like, breaks the rules, like, Western Kentucky gets put on, like, 5 years probation or something like that. Like that's the idea, right? It's like these big schools break rules literally left and right.
Yeah.
And they're never the ones who get actually punished for real, you know?
So we're hearing about, just in general, the NBA draft at some point is supposed to allow high school kids to come back in, whether it's 2021, 2022, whatever the case may be, I don't know. But do we know, A, if that's actually going to have an impact on college basketball to where some of this stuff is not as prevalent because now kids can go, or at least the elite kids can go into the draft. And it looks like the G League is trying to set up a thing where players can go directly there. And just basically players that are 18 years old and are good seemingly are going to have options outside of just college basketball. And I'm wondering how that's going to affect things, because I'm trying to remember, how did that affect college basketball between 1995 and 2005 when kids were coming out often?
Well, I mean, I want to say something to that in that regard. I think what's interesting about that time was there still was this very anti-look at the kid coming out of high school. And for those of us, I think, you know, old enough, I was kind of middle school at the time to really be watching the draft. there still was people were like, no, coming out of high school, don't trust these kids. Kids were slipping. I mean, Kobe went 13th, right? Kevin Garnett.
People were mad at kids actually leaving college early, too.
Right. Kevin Garnett, the year before, what was Kevin Garnett picked? Fifth or sixth? I can't remember, right? Fifth or sixth. Jermaine O'Neal in that same draft as Kobe, you know, not picked. There was not this great thing. It's kind of like, how dare you do this? How should you come out into the league and play? So it's still kind of this resistance I think we're seeing now for, as we know, mostly black players taking agency of their careers and saying, no, I want to go here and want to go this way. And you have all this talk about, oh, it's going to hurt college basketball and this and that and all this stuff where it's like, shouldn't you want these kids to get paid or be in the best place where they can hone their skills to be the best professionals they can be? But it seems that a lot of people don't care about that. And that kind of goes to Jamal's point where it's like, this is the NCAA just kind of showing face on this and try to make look like they look good and care about these kids and student athletes. Well, we know damn well they don't care about these student athletes. We know this.
Right. You know what's interesting, you mentioned that.
I'm actually Googling right now the list of white basketball players who came out of high school, straight out of high school.
That's a great question.
I think only Robert Swift might be there. I don't know who else, actually.
He fell on some hard times.
There's always going to be corruption in the NCAA, even if they decide to pay players, because it's all relative. So okay,
right.
If the NBA opens the draft up to high school players again, as long as there's money, you know, behind the NCAA tournament and behind how well any school's team does, there's going to be competition for the rest of the players. So it's all relative. Mm-hmm. You know, if those 10 players go to the draft, then they're going to try to pay. You know, and try to get those the next 20 best players. They're going to try to get on their campus, and as much money as it takes, they'll do it. So there's always going to be. It's not going to really affect college basketball. It might affect the talent on the court, but it's not going to affect the race to get the best talent that you can.
Here's what I hope happens with the draft opening it back up to high school, with the start of the professional collegiate league, with the more and more players looking at going overseas, with what Darius Bazley did with taking that internship at New Balance. Like, what I want to eventually have happen is, like you said, Murph, I want the top prep basketball talent to go these other avenues away from the NCAA, and the G League, right? Like that, or that's another avenue. I want them all to go to those other avenues and not the NCAA. And I want that next level of, you know, that next tier down, right? Those guys who might be pros, but we're not sure, right?
Four stars, three stars and stuff.
Right,
the guys that come out also might be pros. They don't
Well, right, but you're less certain about that next tier, right? Like, I want them to be the guys, and then I want to see if the play level starts dropping and ratings may also start dropping. If, I don't know, I wonder what then will happen in terms of the viewership and the money when they re-up the deals and all that. Because look, if their thing is we don't want to pay these players whatever, okay, then get a bunch of like people who don't ever want to play pro, just play 4 years of college, don't pay them. You can do your hang on Sloopy, your stuff in the Dean Dome, whatever, knock yourself out for the love of the game. Cool. And you guys all rah-rah, do your love of the game, and don't worry about this excellent basketball being played everywhere else.
That's going to be interesting to hear. Brian and I talk about this all the time. The folks who are always like, college basketball is better than the NBA. If the level of college basketball talent declines, I'm very intrigued to see if people still make that argument, which I've always said is absolutely
the level. The level has declined.
It has. Oh, I agree. It started already. I agree.
They're showing, you know, classic games from the 80s. I just watched Georgetown and North Carolina championship game.
I saw that too.
Worthy was a senior, for God's sakes. You know, Jordan and Ewing were in that game. You know what I'm saying? So you don't have that nowadays at all, and the brand is still, you know, relatively strong. So there is some truth to the league that the NCAA has created. You know, I mean, like a lot of people do, you know, a lot more goes into it than just who is playing and the level of talent. You know, it's regional. It's who's going to win the Big East? Who's going to win the Big Ten?
And alma mater.
Then you have that. You know, the excitement of the NCAA tournament, which no one can duplicate, you know, just the brackets and all that. All best players, because remember, it's just so-called. We just know what they are in high school. You know, there are many kids who are not even top 100 players coming out of high school who have good college careers, and then, you know, Dame Lillard, people like that, you know, they and then go to the pros, become stars. So you can't, you know, it's not that simple. Right. But regardless, you know, of the NCAA talent and what the NBA and the G League are doing, the NCAA is going to have to pay these players, because you're paying for the labor and the time and effort that they are putting in. And we know it's getting closer and closer. This should have been done, how, you know, 50 years ago at least.
Right. But
eventually, they're not going to be able to keep that dam in place for much longer.
Murph, you know, I just want to blow up college athletics. That's really all I want to do.
Yo, you know what? And we're talking about other options that players could have and things of that nature. Another option that I saw, did you guys see this? Because I found this interesting. LaMelo Ball apparently bought the team that he played for in Australia. And I think what the thinking there is, maybe I can get other high school kids to take this route. If you have someone like LaMelo Ball, who might be the first pick in the draft this summer, or whenever the draft is going to be at this point, but if you have LaMelo Ball, try to get kids to go that route, kind of like what LeVar Ball tried to do with the JBA, but obviously it didn't really work to the degree that people thought it would. But if you try to get kids to go that route, and then you're going to start to see more kids perhaps play overseas, maybe buy the team they're on. I mean, LaMelo Ball's got a little bit of a different situation because that family has money, but I think you're going to start to see maybe a little bit of that too. And kids are just going to figure out their own way to sort of do this for a year and then go on to the NBA whatever the next step is.
Remember, that will only be, you know, a very select few who are going to be every year. You're only going to have about 10 players who are really top 10 players.
It's true, but at the end of the day, like, teenagers are dick riders. And if one kid's going to do this here, then another kid's going to do this here, and then another kid's going to do this here, and then it's just going to spread.
Doesn't mean it's going to work out for everybody.
But it's also about...
That's true, because what worked out for Amari Stoudemire didn't work out for D'Angelo Collins, who was sharing his story on the Real Life MTV about how he thought he was as good as Amari. He entered the draft out of high school, was undrafted, and we never heard from him again because he only played overseas. There's going to still happen, because the sheer numbers are only going to allow a small percentage of people, a very small percentage of people, to get into the NBA. But the point is, could you make a living without using the NCAA at all? Could you just go straight to high school and go overseas and just make a lot of money out there?
You could, but only a select few. You know, how many kids is that Australian team willing to pay? Can't be more than 5 or 10 any given year.
They're paying Josh Boone, so I hope they're willing to pay some other kids.
Played four years under a Hall of Fame coach.
I know, became
a good player.
Right, so his value is different.
Let me say something about my childhood real quick. There was a point in my life where I thought Josh Boone was the worst basketball player I ever seen. So
what?
I was like 12 years old. Look,
he's a South Kent guy. He was good enough to be a prep. He was good enough to go to one of those top prep schools in high school.
I know that now, but I'm saying, like, we've all had a few of those guys as a kid. I'm sure you guys had them as well, where you're like, you watch somebody play and you're like, yo, this motherfucker sucks. Like, this is the worst basketball player I've ever seen.
I saw Andrew Bynum play in high school, and I was like, this dude is terrible. I was like, he's going to the NBA draft. He is awful. How's he not dominating these kids?
And I have three. What? I have three other than Josh Boone. It was they're all centers, coincidentally.
Because you love the small guy. What a shock.
No, because if you could be a subpar center and make it to the NBA if you're just big. You know what I mean? If you're just big and know how to stand in a place.
Yeah.
If you're a guard, you have to be nice. You have to be world class to get to the NBA if you're a guard. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, go ahead. Who are these three guys?
Jerome James. Jackie Butler.
Oh God.
And I hated this dude.
Another person played for the Knicks?
No, he almost did because they could have drafted him. Thankfully they didn't. Byron Mullins. Jesus Christ. Oh my God. Nothing against any of them.
I think Josh Boone was definitely better than all them dudes. And I watched a lot of Josh Boone up close and personal in his days of battling Pitt. I didn't like him, but he gave us problems. Christ.
Travis Knight might be another one, too. God. Good God. Right.
The Sports Walk is back. Watch Season 3 of Backpack Broadcasting's original web series that brings you the opinions of real sports fans. The first two seasons and current season are available now for viewing on the Sports Walk YouTube channel and Facebook page. Check out the 2017 NYC WebFest official selection and see what other sports fans have to say on the hottest issues in sports today. It's easy. Just take the Sports Walk.
Guys, one of the things I thought Dan Wetzel, which was a good get for this piece, and I thought he had a lot of great things to say that echoes a lot of what we're saying. I think it was his final comments in the documentary where he talked about how ridiculous it is as a society. Some people will criticize the paying of players, which we all agree the players should be paid. However, he made his analogy was, hey, if Google or Amazon wanted some kid that they thought was talented in high school, and they said, hey, we're going to pay you $20,000 to come out of Silicon Valley for the summer and work for us, nobody would say that's ridiculous. But there is a segment of people that say this is ridiculous here, and I completely agree with them. I've been making that point for a long time that that's ridiculous. But the question I guess I have to everybody here is, our minds are very different, but is the minds of the American public in looking at this, is it changing? Are we seeing a shift? Are people going to look at this as a scheme, the sham? Are we seeing a shift here or not?
No, because there are a lot of people who, even with this stimulus package, are concerned about big businesses and not about the people. So there are just going to be people in America who are concerned about trying to keep other people down in that way. And especially in college athletics, where a majority of the athletes are black and brown, really black, you're looking at a lot of people who just want to support the business in the NCAA and not really care about, you know, whether or not these players are getting played, whether or not they're being treated fairly. It's the same thing that we see in America all the time. Look at that stimulus, baby. They want the billions to go to the big companies, and they don't really care if families are getting $1,200 or $3,600 or whatever it is.
It is, again, this is emblematic of who we are as a society. If you look at who is in favor of paying players and who is not, it falls directly along racial lines. Majority of black people, cool with players getting paid. Majority of white people, not cool with players getting paid. And again, this goes back to how we look at things in this country, right? There is this idea that if you don't have money and you are poor, it is somehow a reflection of your character. It is your fault. You are bad with money. You are wasteful. You're all these terrible things, right? And because of that, you shouldn't have any opportunities or chances. That is how this political system and the way this country has brainwashed its citizenry to think about our most vulnerable people. And that's how people think about people. As if anyone wakes up and decides, I want to be poor today. Who the hell thinks of that? Nobody wants that. But that's how people think, right?
It's also, you know, we always talk about crabs in a bucket, and we mm-hmm. talk about minorities specifically, but it goes across racial lines. So, you know, majority of white people in this country are poor. So they're looking at a black person who could possibly make money, and they're not trying to hear that. You know, they're like, why should this black person make it, and I'm not making it here. You know, I do think that things are changing, you know, just by almost osmosis or whatever, because it's happening, you know, so people are becoming desensitized to it. Like we talked about off camera in terms of, you know, now there's more players, you know, back in the day, less players were coming out. You couldn't even come out of high school, like, you know, what was it, 20 years ago? Now you can. So people are desensitized to it. I do see even more and more people like, hey, you know, yeah, he has to come out. It's, you know, he had a great freshman year. Like, no, even the most racist, poor white person in middle America is not going to be mad at Zion Williamson coming out of school last year. Like, even they got that. You know what I'm saying? Like, all right, fine. Even Duke fan, I don't think there was one Duke fan that was like, no, he's got to come back. Oh, he's a jerk. How could he leave us? You know what I'm saying? I don't think that exists. So, but to someone else, they are like that. So I think it is changing a little bit, not fast enough. But the definitely more and more people enough. Do what they have to do, they don't have, there's no choice but for people to change.
Well, I will say this. and Murph, you know her. I spoke to Victoria Jackson about this from Arizona State and Andy Schwartz, who's an NCAA economist. And look, the NCAA is really good at dragging its feet on any kind of change, right? So everybody got all excited when the pay-to-play adoption and different laws were being signed by these states. NCAA ain't do a mumbling thing about that.
Right.
They out here like, okay, we formed a special committee to look into it. MFers, you don't need a special committee to look into it. You've been knowing about this for the last 100 years. There's no committee you need to research how this is going to work, right? And they're going to give you all the excuses. Well, if we pay the basketball players, we got to pay the water polo and tennis players. No, you don't, my friend.
No, you don't.
It works the same way every other economic system works. If your business generates a profit, that's how income's received. Look at every single sport as a business unit. Oh, you in the black? Cool. Figure out how you're going to pay your people. You in the red? Shit. I got nothing for you. We're not bailing you out here, right? If you cannot generate a profit with your sport, your players don't get paid, period. End of story, right?
The NCAA is not trying to change. We know that.
Right.
You know, they're trying to, you know, keep making this money off of, you know, minorities' backs. Like, that's entirely what they're trying to do. You're right. They came up with this fraudulent committee. That really didn't address any of the issues. It didn't even, you know, just the makeup of the committee was a joke. You know, you didn't have any ex-players on there who really went through it, who could really, you know, tell you how it really is in terms of what kind of market they might have. So we know the NCAA is not going to do this on their own. It's going to be pressure from other people. And we talk about, you know, now we're in this, you know, coronavirus has stopped everything. The NCAA is already using this as an excuse to do anything next year. I guess we can't play next year. You know, all this stuff happened. You know, I'm in my house. I can't do the work from my house to get them paid.
and I'm sure you guys all know this, but again, you know, you look at the NCAA uses the word amateurism, and all the great people have talked about this who know about the history of college.
Yes,
like Victoria Jackson. Andy Schwartz, like I mentioned, Taylor Branch wrote excellent pieces on the NCAA and its cartel, right? Because that's essentially what they are.
Word.
It is a non-for-profit entity that rakes in billions of dollars, meaning they pay zero taxes on that money,
which
then farm out to their member institution schools, who are also non-for-profit entities, who just take in hundreds of millions and just, woo!
Which Dawkins pointed out in the piece.
Yes.
Every university, because they're non-profit, they can't show money on their balance sheet at the end of their fiscal or however they do their money. So what they going to do with that money? Spend it. Guess who ain't getting it? Players.
Players. Right?
And how many new libraries are you going to build?
A lot of what these schools will do, especially the big time schools, and for those of us who know, who've been to some of these campuses, they will try to show it and say, "Oh, we're putting the money back into the athletic program. We've built this new locker room. We've built this new training facility." And they'll sell that. But what I have learned with a lot of those things that people should be aware of is a lot of these schools, you know how they're actually doing it? They're getting donations from former players who will come back and give them the money. So it's not actually the money that they're generating through the TV deals and all that stuff. And that is the big sham and all that. That still, it's like players are still giving back to the system. And I kind of want to tell these players, like, yo, man, nah, don't do that.
And those facilities are just recruiting tools. They're not helping any of the players who did the work for you or players that are there now. That's for the future and players to be bamboozled.
Bamboozled is a great word there, Jamal, because that is exactly it.
And by the way, and I don't blame them because they're young and they don't know, but these athletes, they are part of the bamboozling process unknowingly, right? What do we see on Instagram and on our Twitter feeds every 2 seconds?
I was going to mention this.
Right? Brand new athletic complex opened up. They go to their lockers. They got the new Nike backpack with the new J's in it. Yo, look what I got. It's so fresh.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm not hating. Get your new fresh J's. Get your new fresh warm-up and all your cool stuff. But my man, them J's going to pay for your dinner when you're hungry 3 months from now? Like, all these things.
And what you're doing is you're marketing the school, basically. Yes. You're marketing the school's athletic program. You're doing exactly what they want because it's a bunch of people.
telling you, see, don't you want to be like them? Look how much fun they're having.
It's like, yo, you get a bunch of people in a room. You're like, all right, how are we gonna keep the black kids coming to our program, also, right? Here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna put a slip and slide in our locker room, and then we're gonna fucking put an Instagram video, 15 seconds of everybody just enjoying that shit. Whoop whoop whoop, one by one, put that shit out. Boom, marketing. How many kids are gonna tell their mom, like, yo, son, I want to go on that slip and slide, yo. I want to play at Alabama.
I never say, I want to go to LSU.
And it's also the shoe companies doing the exact same thing.
100%.
The exact same thing. Going down even before college, obviously, AAU programs. Grassroots. You know, so it's not just the universities. The Nike plays a part. Under Armour, Adidas, all of them are playing a huge part in it.
No. Yeah. Great. Jamal, I'm glad you brought that up, because I'd watched that for years covering high school basketball. Brian did the same. I've literally seen it. There is so much money that goes into these AAU programs from these sneaker companies. Ooh. They are everywhere. I mean, people who aren't in around that world, you might not understand. But when I say they are everywhere, they are everywhere. And you get to know these players, and you get to see how it works and how the money is funneled down to the high school level to just even a competition like in New York City just trying to keep kids. Go ahead. Right.
And it's also true. Think about it in terms of what it does to a kid, because we also talk about when they're in college or in the pros, we wonder why these players aren't more proactive, and why aren't they questioning the system? Because they've been bred not to ask questions. You know, since they were 10 years old, they were getting free sneakers, like you said, and hype over it. Oh, I got J's. Oh, you know how you keep those J's? You shut up. You know what I'm saying? You don't say anything.
Word.
Go to the team that gives you those, and then shut the hell up. And you learn that at age 10. So when you're 18.
But I want to add something to that, that a lot of this that happens, because something that Gerard touched upon before, is these are happening in many lower income communities where there are a lot of black and brown folks in there. And so think about it. If you're from those communities, I've seen this in Coney Island in Brooklyn. I've seen it in tons of other places across New York City and communities I've covered. These kids, if you're 10 years old, 11 years old, like Jamal is saying, and you're getting a free backpack and some kicks and some gear to go play this game, and your mama's working two jobs, yo, you ain't going to say shit at all either, because you're like, yo, I'm getting these kicks.
And on top of that, you're at a high school where they're traveling to Miami, or they're traveling to California for these holiday tournaments mid-season. You're like a college team now. Like, I remember being in – At an event, I'm not going to be too specific about it, because I actually do like the school, and I could, use that relationship a little bit. But there was one school this coach pulled out stacks of money. So I've never seen this much at a high school before.
I've seen
pulled
it.
Pulled out stacks of money. I don't even know what it was for. He was counting to make sure all the funds were good. I'm like, dog, I'm going to tell you who it is off mic.
Yeah. You tie it back to Christian Dawkins. I mean, what did he say? He read the book Soul Influence. Soul Influence tells you how this whole game is played. That was his inspiration. He said, wait a minute. This is a multi-billion dollar industry. I don't want the whole thing. I just want my little slice of the pie. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, that is the American way, is it not?
Yeah.
For some people. Because they ain't going to let everybody get a seat at the table or a slice of that pie, as we know.
They'll change the rules on you quick. Yep. It's like they've been doing that forever. On the court and off the court.
Off the court. Yo, you trying to get a seat at this table? You're trying to get a slice of this pie? Nah, not so fast. And I mean, that's kind of the tragedy. And I know Brian talked about it being the Christian Dawkins story, and to some degree it was, but that is the kind of tragedy for Christian Dawkins in this situation, right? That, Gerard, you bring up the fact that this is what he wanted. He saw how he could play the game. He was kind of playing within the rules of the game that was already out there and created, and still he's been vilified for this.
He's a convicted
felon.
Yes.
And you want to talk about the, Brian had an issue with how it ended and him talking about his record deal. It was funny that he mentioned, this is the only thing I could do. I'm a convicted felon, so I'm trying to think what I could do as a convicted felon. Music. I could go into music.
Yeah. Well, because his options are limited.
Which, by the way, look, is a smart thing to do, because that's one of the few, I mean, there are some other things you could do, but you probably shouldn't. And I'll just keep that there. But in terms of how Christian Dawkins handled his business, because again, my issue is not with him, it's more so how the documentary is presented. But in terms of how he handled his business, I felt like he did everything, I wouldn't say by the book, but by the unofficial book that like if you're trying to become an agent and you're trying to go about your business in that way, he made all the right moves and did all the right steps. He was just better at it than some other people.
And to
he should have trusted his instincts more because he said a couple times like he was thinking to himself like this is crazy. Dude is weird. What's he doing? He's just trying to set
he should have listened to himself.
It's hard to turn away that cash, man. When that cash was right in front of you, like
and to defend Christian Dawkins too. At the time, he's 24, 25 years old. You haven't been around that long. I think
probably 22.
Yeah, you haven't been around that. Yeah. You haven't been around that long, so you don't really know who you're I mean, shit, I'm 26 now, and there are still times where it's like, yo, this dude's a little funky. Like, I don't really know. And, you know what the case?
And he wasn't the only one. The FBI agents themselves got in trouble for taking the money.
Yo, yes. Okay.
We're mad at Christian Dawkins when the agents running the investigation
took the money.
Are now, you know, there's misappropriating funds from them for misappropriating funds out in Vegas, taking some of those stacks.
Right, but the FBI was real quiet about that. We don't hear anything about that. I think what I'm tired is the FBI. It is disappointing the FBI didn't speak. And I know we also didn't mention it was Sarai McDonald who also wrote an article for Undefeated about how, you know, to Brian's point, this kind of felt like very centered on Christian Dawkins. And I understand the point where she was coming from too, and where what Brian is saying too. But when you don't have the FBI speak on this. When you don't have the NCAA, who, Jamal, you know this too, they don't ever speak on anything. I mean, I've watched numerous HBO Real Sports pieces where they, because they love shaming the NCAA, and I love them for that. Mm-hmm. They don't speak on it. They never say anything on it all the time. And like, when is the time that the NCAA is going to be so shamed, it's going to be like, damn, y'all got to speak?
Never.
Maybe, you know what? Now that I'm thinking about it, maybe it would have helped to get more players' perspective because Fred VanVleet was there and he had one quote because he's worked with Christian Dawkins before. But I would think that if you're trying to flame the NCAA, which evidently you are, there are a lot of players, DeMarcus Cousins and a whole bunch of others, Draymond Green, who have been very, very vocal about just disliking the NCAA, how they go about their business, and players who have probably had experience with money and the case may be, who might not care if certain banners and accomplishments get revoked from them anyway, because it's always going to be there. Unfortunately, that Louisville team had a national title stripped from them, but you mean to tell me if I... Yeah, but if I go up to Montrezl Harrell and Terry Rozier and Russ Smith and guys who were on that team, Peyton Siva, and be like, yo, do you not feel like a champion? They're going to look at me like I'm stupid. You know what I mean? So at the end of the day, we know who wins.
And not just players, other black assistant coaches who are still in the game.
Yep.
I noticed a lot of them on Twitter, guys we've heard of, you know, ex-players who are now assistant coaches. They, you know, they spoke out on Twitter, you know, in support of Dawkins. And I think it gets to the point where they have to understand the leverage they have. Oh, you want me to do this recruiting, to bring this kid in? I want to be more than just a recruiter. I want, you need to move me up the ladder in terms of assistant coaches. I need to be your, offensive assistant
lead coach,
your defensive assistant. Mm-hmm. You know, understand the leverage you have. If you are the person responsible for bringing, superstar caliber players into a program, you need to use that leverage yourself and make sure you're not going to be just some sort of scapegoat. I need to be doing this, for a reason professionally, and I need to see it right away.
Can I point this out? Because I found this hilarious, too. Now that we're also talking about players, did you guys see the amount of players who were tweeting out on behalf of the documentary, hashtag HBO partner, hashtag the scheme HBO? I'm like, yo, they actually put some – they definitely paid some people to try to get this out there. Like, it was a funny-ass – Van Lathan and Fred Joseph had a watch party online, Tobias Harris, Karen Civil – Bria Hartley, Count on Vic, Isaiah Thomas. I was like, this is such an interesting selection group of people that HBO went after that I just found funny.
You know, it is interesting, this whole NCAA thing. We talked about, will they ever get shamed? And Merv and I just said never. And it's because the infrastructure that has been created is so solid. Everyone is brainwashed into this amateurism thing, right? When you hear and you ask the average person, why don't they play college players? Because they're amateurs. And we all know, ain't nothing amateur about what they're doing. Right. Nothing is amateur about it. Everything from what majors they can take, when they go to class, et cetera, is dictated by the sport in which they play. has zero to do with amateurism, right? But the machine has been created. They pump out their propaganda every March. A million of our athletes go something pro and other something other than sports and all that BS that they do. And they have their plants in the media who love to come out with their stories about the NCAA. And we know who they are. I ain't going to mention their names, right? That's just what it is, right? Yeah, and so once you have that, it ain't never changing.
Yeah, there's nothing amateur about playing any sport, you know, in front of 100,000 fans, 80,000 right. fans, 20,000 fans, amateur. Whatever it is. So, you know, you need to get that word out of there. It makes no sense. You're not an amateur. Like I said, I'm watching 1982 championship game. This has been going on forever. Mm-hmm. I'm watching 1982 championship game. There's 60,000 people in the stands watching that. You know, they're playing in the Superdome. They're filling the Superdome in the early 80s. You know, you can go back even further. You know what I'm saying? So the amateur, like, let's, I mean, I don't know what we have to do. I do think people are becoming desensitized to it. More people understand that, even if they're haters at heart or they're racist at heart or they don't want people to be able to reach their full potential, fine. But they do see what's going on. Nobody in their right mind could really think that this is amateur stuff.
Murph, what I appreciate about you, man, you have such a wonderful perspective on your fellow human. You give them so much more credit than I do because I give them none. Literally zero.
No, for the fact, Brian, you got any final thoughts you have on this? I mean, I'm kind of leaning towards never with Murph and Jamal on this. I'm a little pessimistic about things with NCAA. Any final thoughts from you?
I think once a lot of the people who subscribe to that level of thinking die, you'll start to see some change.
I mean, that's not crazy.
Because the thing is, I'm looking at like, your generation, my generation, there's generally a different way of thinking, right? And a lot of the people who think the way they do, there are some younger people, like you're going to have a Tommy Lauren and a Candace Owens, et cetera, et cetera. But the majority of those people who think a certain way are older and are kind of dying off. You know, like how Dan Le Batard jokes that the average baseball fan, the median age is death. Because the average baseball fan is basically like 56 years old. So you look at people who subscribe to that way of thinking, and a lot of those people are going to die off, whereas a lot of people generally growing up are a little bit more progressive now. So I do think that in due time, yes, things are going to generally change. Politics, how we feel about the NCAA, I think that stuff is going to shift. But it's I don't know what's the timeline. Is it 20 years? You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what that looks like. But in due time, things just generally change.
I'd agree with that. And I think it's important why, you know, as Murph said at the beginning of this, I think it's important that you have, you know, pieces like this. I think it's important when you have stories that like Murph wrote or, you know, Gerard covering it and being able to speak with directors and having all that. And us just talking about it in the podcast.
Yeah,
I think that stuff's definitely important.
Because just think about like, because in order, like, let me look at this optimistically. Think about societally what has happened since the Fab Five threw their warm-ups down and came out with blank T-shirts and wore black socks. Like, a lot has been a lot of progress has been made, and we're talking about a window that's a little under 30 years.
Right.
So, what are the next 30 years going to look like? Or rather, since things are moving so rapidly now, what are the next 15 years going to look like? You know what I mean? In a post Donald Trump as president America,
can't wait.
How are things going to look like? And I feel like that's important because when you look at how things are and how business is moving, I mean, if you look at the dude who has the president's seat right now, there are a lot of things that have been done to sort of reflect that. And a lot of decisions have been made to sort of reflect that. Now, once you get him out and things are different, we hope at least, but things are a little bit different, at least in terms of how things look and how things act, then, you know, we'll start to see what happens after that.
Well, let me just say one thing with Christian Dawkins. One thing he mentioned too that was really, you know, it was like a one-off, but he mentioned football, and he said, you know, imagine what these football guys are making, because we all know that football is America's sport.
We don't really hear about football money changing hands like that.
Why is that? Because you know, if it's happening in basketball, it's probably happening 10 times as
ten
much
times
in football.
And worse.
We don't hear about that. Do they have more protection?
I think the boosters in football. I think
they're way more insulated.
Yep. They're way more insulated in those communities. Like, so if you go to Alabama or you go to, you know, Baton Rouge, LSU,
Clemson,
right? Those boosters, them boosters are around, at all the time. Mm-hmm. And if you've been to any of those places, you can see it, especially in the South and the SEC. Different world. Yeah. Different world.
You read about it. The governor of these states are like, yeah, no, we ain't messing with that. Like that. So listen, man, it is entrenched. The one thing we do know, right? Change does soon come, but it comes slow.
Like you want it to get here fast, but it's like, I mean, but
it's never been that.
To me, there's just no benefit in looking things at a pessimistic way when usually it isn't that bad. So,
well look, change. You're right, Gerard. Change is slow. It always has been, always will be. But you know, we got to keep fighting a good fight, talk about these things, and shaming these idiots.
Absolutely,
that's what we got to do. All right, that is it for episode 119 of the Ain't Hard Tell podcast. We want to thank our guest Jamal Murphy, also known as the Black Catologist. You can check out his article on The Undefeated. You can check him out on The Bros Pod and all the great writing he does for The Undefeated. Our other guest, Gerard Hector, you can also check him out. 7 Footers Pod, our good friends from there. And writing's got some stuff coming out on this, on The Scheme. That'll be on BET, right, Gerard?
Well, it's going to be on BET. And then I got some podcast interviews coming out on 7 Footers, kind of expanding a little bit. So
okay,
that'll be good, man.
There we go. So a lot of good stuff, more good content coming out. We'll have more stuff with these guys too. So that's it for our two guests, for Brian Fonseca, who still isn't too angry and isn't promoting prostitution on campuses everywhere.
Well, not now. Social distancing. Not now.
Okay. Good to know. He's being responsible in that regard. Until next time, y'all. Peace.
Peace.